He was also one of the nation's first Air Force ROTC candidates to qualify and to complete the grueling 3-week U.S. Army Airborne Infantry Paratrooper training course. Dale is a director and volunteer pilot for Air Lifeline. That's a nonprofit national charitable medical transportation organization who fly needy persons free of charge to receive some sort of medical emergency medical treatment, something like that. He is also a member of the Writers Guild, of course, a life member of the Air Force Association and U.S. Naval Institute. Dale is a multi-engine and instrument-rated private pilot and can also often be found in the skies all across the U.S. piloting his own plane. He is also the author of, as I mentioned, 11 consecutive New York Times best-selling military action aviation adventure novels, which I think all really kind of came from Flight of the Old Dog, I guess, in a way. Dale Brown, welcome to the program. What an honor.
Thank you very much. It's an honor for me to be here, Art. Thank you very much.
You just really crank them out, and I eat them up. I mean, it's just, and I guess you've got a gigantic readership out there who just sort of, and now you're in a position, you've got to be in a position, Dale, where all you've got to do is turn out a book, and it's like automatically going to be a bestseller.
I'm not sure if it's that automatic. I have to sell every book, and I go out there. I love doing book signings. I love doing appearances. I love doing radio, and it's a real privilege being on your show. But I have to sell every book as if it's the first book, and that's always been a real treat for me.
All right. Well, we have so much we can talk about. You indeed used to be in B-52s, and I was Air Force, but I was a medic, and I was in a hospital, and so I didn't experience what you have, B-52s, F-111s, but with regard to the B-52, it's a legendary aircraft. They fly now, right?
Yeah, they sure do. We have about 60 of them in the active inventory. They're all B-52Hs, but the youngest one was built in... it rolled off the assembly line in 1963.
Wow.
That's the newest one we have.
That's the newest one.
Yep. But the thing about the B-52, of course, is that for most of their life, up until about 1991, about the middle of 1991, they didn't fly very much. Their job was to pull alert. And that's what I did on them for 4 years. They sat for 10 months out of the year getting ready to fight World War III. So before they started flying them more regularly, like an Operation Desert Storm, they had very few hours on the airframe. So they were still almost new jets.
I see. I can't even imagine what it was like sitting in a B-52. And I guess, now, do you always know when it's a training exercise or not?
For the training flights, yes, you definitely knew that those were training flights. But when you sat alert, especially in the B-52, now the FB-111 was a different mission and a different mindset with the FB-111s. They didn't really like to exercise those jets too much. They were only at the time when there were at a time when there was 300 B-52s in the inventory. There were only 40 FB-111s on alert, so they didn't really want to bend those airplanes. But when I pulled alert on the B-52s, when the horn went off, you never knew if that was the real thing or if that was just an exercise. And the perfect example of a defining moment in your life is when I actually copied my first and only actual combat message pulling alert in the B-52, where when you run out to the airplanes, you know, the klaxon goes off, you run out to the airplanes. We had out there at Mather Air Force Base in Sacramento at the time, we had 12 B-52s sitting round the clock alert, six guys per airplane plus the KC-135 tankers. We had 10 of those sitting alert also. All those air crews running out there, getting the airplane ready to taxi. When the klaxon goes off, your order is to start engines copy the coded message and prepare for takeoff. That's the automatic response. But when you pull alert, of course, you get the intelligence briefings every day. You sort of know what the world situation is. You know what the political situation is. You know what the military situation is. But you still never know when the horn goes off if it's the real thing or not. So our job as the navigator and the radar navigator was to get inside the airplane, make sure the power was on, and then copy the coded message that was being broadcast by the command post. And the first few letters would tell you immediately if it was an exercise or the actual or an actual go-to-war message.
You were carrying nuclear weapons.
Yes, absolutely. We had both gravity weapons and missiles, plus a full load of fuel. We were half a million pounds gross weight getting ready for takeoff.
Oh my God, Dale, what's it like to be? I don't even know where to begin. Just to be carrying nuclear weapons alone has got to be a kind of a strange, unsettling situation to be in. I mean, you're going to try and get to a target. For example, all right, here's a good question. Let's say that the real thing happened. What were your calculated chances of making it to your target, dropping your weapons, and then getting out alive?
Our chances actually were very, very good.
Really?
The reason was that the B-52s would actually be part of the third wave that would go in. Of course, the intercontinental ballistic missiles were the first ones to go.
Right.
Both the land-launched ones and the sea-launched ones.
Right.
So we were actually the fourth wave. Each target that you would have would be already deconflicted with other explosions going off nearby. Your entire route, in fact, would be deconflicted. So the idea was that those initial attacks, first of all, would take care of some of those the land-based defenses. They would take care of things like the enemy airfields. So hopefully the defenses would pretty much be knocked down by the time the B-52s would arrive. And that was done on purpose, of course, because the B-52s at that time were much more accurate and much more reliable, and they were the only weapon systems that you could recall the weapons.
That's right.
If the Soviets survived the initial laydown from the missiles, and if they wanted to call it off at that point, they could send us a coded message, and we would respond to that, and we would immediately reverse course.
How much were you, as part of a B-52 crew, told about the reality of a nuclear conflict? If we had an all-out nuclear conflict with the Soviets, would there be much to call off? I mean, after we had fired our missiles and they had fired theirs, how much would be left? Did you guys really know?
The idea was that we knew exactly what our position in the whole strategic outlook was. We knew that the chances of us actually being called upon to actually drop a weapon in the Soviet Union or wherever our target was very, very slim. We knew precisely what our job was, and our job was to prove to the Soviet Union, prove to the People's Republic of China, and actually prove to the rest of the world that we were ready to do it. That the United States was committed with those expenditures of aircraft, air crews, weapons, fuel, and all the infrastructure necessary in order to have us sit 24-hour alert 365 days a year and get ready to do it. And it wasn't just us being on alert, but it was us exercising. They would monitor our exercises very precisely, and they would have a stopwatch on us also. And they would time us how quick it took us to start engines, how quickly it took us to taxi to the runway and actually get ready to launch.
From the time the klaxon went off until you could get safely into the air would be how long?
About 5 minutes.
5 minutes. a lot longer than it would take for an ICBM to blow your base to smithereens.
Right. On normal alert, all the aircraft were positioned based on the missile flight time at that point. And of course, we would have sub chasers out there in the Pacific or the Atlantic, pinpointing as closely as possible where the Soviet submarines were stationed. If they moved to a certain distance based on the projected missile flight time, we were on normal alert. If they moved in closer, then they would step up our alert status. Sometimes they would restrict us to the alert facility. We couldn't go out into the base like normal. If they moved in even closer, they would reposition the planes as if we had already taxied onto the runway. And if they moved in even closer, we would actually sit alert inside the airplanes with our fingers on the battery power switch ready to start the engines. We could start all 8 engines almost simultaneously, so we could have the engines running in 2 minutes and be off the ground probably 60 seconds later.
My
God. All depended on that missile flight time.
Dale, hold on one second. I lied a little. I got started with this interview so quickly, I didn't do the normal break I would do at the beginning of this hour. So let me take care of that now. Here you go. Wonder how many of you have ever seen a B-52. Certainly in the movies or on television, but it doesn't do justice to the sheer size of those aircraft. They're unbelievable. I lived off base at Kadena Air Base on Okinawa when we were flying our B-52s, into Vietnam and beyond, actually. And they used to roar down the runway every few seconds at times, and things would rattle off the walls in my house. It was just an astounding aircraft. It is an astounding aircraft, having your fingers on those switches ready to start 8 engines. And Dale, I guess all of you went through psychological profiles, didn't you?
Yes, sure did.
I mean, I could see, for example, not having too hard a time dispatching a gravity bomb, for example, on top of an ICBM site. But dispatching one on top of a medium to large Russian city, that's a different story, kind of.
Well, I think for a young lieutenant and a young captain, as I was when I was flying the B-52 and the FB-111, it really wasn't any different. All the targets were pretty much the same, and you were very concerned about your mission. You're very concerned about your fellow crew members. As a lieutenant in the B-52, as a navigator, my job was to get the airplane where we're supposed to be on time.
Right.
And that was a flight plan. That was the navigation equipment. That was the radar scope. And that's pretty much my whole world.
But it was to get a specific job done, though.
I never really thought about the job itself. I knew that my job was to get the aircraft to the initial point where the radar navigator took over from there, and he actually dropped the bombs. I never really thought about the actual targets. I knew exactly what the targets were and where they were positioned in relation to population centers and things like that, but I never really thought about how many thousands or how many even millions of people I would kill after releasing those weapons.
I don't know if there are things, even after all these years, that you cannot discuss, but do you recall anything about the bombs you carried, the megatonnage? Did you know?
I knew all about them. We pre-flighted them every day. We checked them over very carefully. We got briefings. We had to certify twice a year on what the weapons were, what their effects were, what all the safety features of the weapons were. We knew them upside down and backwards. Now, it's not like Hollywood where we knew how to disarm them, how to fix them if they broke and things like that, but we knew all the procedures for how they were handled on the airplane. We had very specific procedures about keeping them out of enemy hands in case we had to crash land or or ditch or things like that. So we knew quite a bit about the weapons. We knew about their megatonnage. We knew exactly what they could do and what they couldn't do.
Are you able to say how big they were?
The main gravity weapons were for the B-52. They were the B-81 bomb, which actually had we called a dial-a-boom. It could
dial-a-boom.
It was actually selectable anywhere from, I believe, 150 kilotons up to 1.1 megatons.
Oh my God.
For the FB-111, the basic weapon was the B-63, which could be carried externally on the aircraft and go supersonic, which was great for the FB-111. So the B-6, that weapon, I believe, was 300 kilotons.
300 kilotons.
That's about 20 times larger than the weapon that destroyed Hiroshima.
And how many weapons were carried by a? That's a big aircraft.
Yeah, the B-52 had four of the large gravity weapons in the forward part of the bomb bay, and then it had a rotary launcher in the back part of the bomb bay that launched the short range attack missile. We had eight of those on the rotary launcher, and those had a range of anywhere from about 30 miles out to about 60 miles, and they were designed to destroy the surface-to-air missiles. As we were going coast in, we would launch those missiles first, and they would destroy the enemy air defenses, the enemy airfields close to the coast, so that would allow us to go in behind them.
Well, close counts with horseshoes, hand grenades, and atomic weapons, right?
Right, absolutely. The missiles were fairly accurate. They were, after flying for that distance, they had an accuracy of probably a quarter of a mile or so. They were supersonic missiles. You couldn't really shoot them down. They had a selectable a flight path. Some of them would go completely ballistic for the really long-range ones. Some of them could go a terrain following and stay very low, almost impossible to shoot them down. The gravity weapons depended on the skill of the crew and the capabilities of the airplane. How much avionics and equipment you still had after making the 8+ hour flight across the ocean.
Yes.
If you were at that time, of course, we didn't use GPS and things like that. We relied on radar for gross navigation. We relied on celestial navigation. We had some inertial navigation stuff. But if you had everything working properly and you had a really good crew, dropping a weapon from low altitude, say 300, 400 feet above the ground, you could probably get the weapon easily within 100 or 200 feet of the target. That's classic.
Yo, man, the whole movie is classic, and that was Slim on his way down. Of those two movies, Dr. Strangelove and Failsafe, which one, Dale, do you think might have been closer to reality?
I think a lot of people would be surprised, but I would say Dr. Strangelove.
Everybody would have said Failsafe, of course.
Well, Failsafe looked and felt, of course, the most realistic. But it is really surprising to me how very close they got Dr. Strangelove. The whole thing with General Ripper kind of losing it and all that. That's not anywhere near reality. But the air crews, what the air crews were going through, and what they did on their way to the target, the decisions they made.
Right.
All those procedures were amazingly accurate, and that's a really good look at what the air crews go through when they have to make a decision about whether or not they have a valid execution, whether or not they're going to go for for which target, if they don't have the capability of losing, of making it to one target, are they going to go for the other targets, or exactly what they do.
Was there a point of no return, even with B-52s? In other words, was there a final, I don't care what you hear, you finished the mission?
Yes, absolutely. If you receive, just like the movie, if you received a valid execution message, it was confirmed by the crew, and everybody agrees that it's a valid message, that was your order to go. And if you heard nothing else, or if you heard you know, voices on the radio saying, you know, don't do it, don't drop those weapons, I'm ordering you not to do it,
right,
you could continue on your mission until you received another valid message ordering you to turn around or to withhold your weapons.
So even the apparent voice of the President of the United States or whatever else at some point could be ignored and you'd just go ahead.
Absolutely. You had to, the message had to be in the proper format and the right order and then authenticated with the documents that you have on board the airplane. And if it was a voice, even if it was your wife's voice on the radio,
right,
saying, don't do it, the war is over,
right,
please believe me, you were obligated to continue on that mission. If folks remember the movie Crimson Tide,
oh,
had to do with a submarine crew going,
yes,
through the same thing.
That's right.
That one, for an ex-bomber guy faced with that decision all the time, that was that for me, that would have been a very easy decision. And I think Denzel Washington's character was wrong. I mean, he didn't have the authority to say, okay, let's wait and see, let's do something else, let's stop what we're doing, stop the checklist, go up to the surface and try to copy another message. They had a valid execution order, they were obligated to follow it, even though Denzel's character saying, oh, it didn't make sense, no, we shouldn't be doing this,
could have actually resulted in a court-martial.
Absolutely. And they would have been fully in their rights to do it, even if it was something happened in the world that they didn't really want to go to war. There was a very specific procedure to follow, and you were obligated to do it.
Well, Dale, even as much psychological profiling as I'm sure everybody went through, if you were on an actual mission, became aware you were in the air past fail-safe points, if they really have such a thing. By the way, do they?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, that's all real, huh?
Yeah, they were called the positive control turnaround point.
Uh-huh.
And if you launched, you had to follow the mission timing, which also came in a coded message. If a lot of those... The timing, most of the planes that launch would actually go into an orbit area, a fail-safe orbit, and then when the proper time came, you left the orbit, and there was a specific point on the globe that you actually crossed, where basically all the aircraft would cross to deconflict those aircraft from each other, because we had 300 B-52s sitting alert at that point.
Right.
And, plus all the other aircraft, their aircraft from Europe, the FB-111s were faster than us. All those aircraft had to be deconflicted. There were spy planes up that had to make sure they weren't in the area when an explosion went off. So everybody had to cross that point on Earth at a specific time, and that was the navigator's job, to get that airplane over that point.
Yeah, and you said as a navigator, you kind of wrapped yourself into just getting it where it was supposed to be without thinking about the larger mission, perhaps. But, you know, there was, how many on a crew of a B-52 typically?
Yeah, back then there were six guys on a B-52. Now there are only five. There's no more tail gunner anymore.
Okay. Well, you know, out of five or six people, if it really came down to what is the end of the world, you know, I think, do you agree that World War III, if carried out all the way, would be, for us, the end of the world? Would it be?
No, absolutely not.
Oh, a very contrarian view.
Yeah, I definitely believe that nuclear war is not only possible, but very probable, and it would not be the end of the world. In fact, I wrote a novel about it, a Plan of Attack, which deals exactly with that question.
That's right.
a very limited nuclear attack. Somebody
No.
could order a nuclear attack and then promise the other side that was a response, that attack brings us to parity. Yes, it was a bolt out of the blue. Yes, it was unprovoked, all this and that. But now we're equal, and I promise I'm going to stop. And if you're smart, you won't retaliate. And I believe, I truly believe that in the case of the United States, we would not retaliate.
Okay, that was going to be my next question. We should discuss that book a little bit. I thought it was an awesome book, by the way.
Thank you.
So the general contention of the book was that we're hit. We get hit, and hit pretty hard. And as you point out, then the promise is, well, we won't go any further if you don't. But if you do, then it's full nuclear war. Actually, my initial question to you is, if we had an all-out World War III, and by all-out I mean we've used it all, you know, the ICBMs, the sub-launch stuff, and then finally the B-52s or whatever else we've got in the air these days, and we dropped everything we had, and they dropped everything they had, would that be the end of the world?
No, I still don't think it would be. I think the areas of devastation would be very isolated. They would be very really restricted, really to the northern hemisphere. I think the amount of damage, especially in Russia, the targets are so concentrated in one specific area, if you're talking about the population areas, and then going after ICBM sites, they're very scattered across a very large continent. So I really don't think, even if it was all-out nuclear war, it would. Now there would be a lot of devastation for many years or even many decades after that, but I don't believe it would be the end of the world.
You wouldn't have a scenario where the radiation poisoning would virtually, you'll remember this movie, wipe out North America and then circulate to the southern hemisphere eventually, ultimately killing everybody. You don't believe that at all?
No.
And the military, so this kind of thing, were you instructed on this kind of thing about what would happen? And do you think that they might have sort of, I don't know, given you the optimistic side of it, making your mission perhaps easier than it otherwise would be?
Well, we were very used to getting the optimistic view of the entire mission.
Huh.
When you look at your mission, and even you were relying on a lot of things to happen. You're relying on that initial nuclear laydown, but I mean, in order to keep the aircraft safe from enemy defenses, but that meant that you were flying through dozens and perhaps hundreds of nuclear explosions, and you're relying on the ability on the planners to keep you away from the explosions far enough where you wouldn't fly through a mushroom cloud.
Right.
But still, you knew you were going to do it. You knew there was going to be fallout all around you. There would be the electromagnetic pulse shutting down communications. Disrupting radar. By the time you actually made it over to your target, exactly how much of your airplane would still be working?
Did they understand then, and you were in the B-52s in what years, Dale?
I started in 1978 and finished up in 1984.
So I suppose by then they did understand what the effects of EMP would be?
Oh, very much so.
And
they assured us that even, even the B-52s back in the late 70s, were hardened enough that we could survive most of it. Now we practiced on a continual basis about releasing weapons, no matter what kind of equipment you had, and we could release weapons just based on airspeed and time, and with nothing else except for a whiskey compass, we had the capability of getting weapons off the B-52. With no hydraulic power, no pneumatic power, no electrical power, we could pull a handle on the ceiling and we can open up the bomb doors and drop the bombs out. And we were trained to do it based on time and heading, just dead reckoning.
And ride one down like Slim if you had to, I suppose. Probably not, but
they were back there. You could kind of squeeze through the hatch, and you can
really
go back there and jump on one.
But, oh my God!
But it's—I mean, you know—parts of that movie were crazy, but actually, most of the movie was really dead on. And Failsafe, of course, you know, felt more tense and more accurate and everything. But boy, you know, Dr. Strangelove was hauntingly. Really chillingly accurate.
Dale, if I ask something that you can't answer, then just say so.
Oh, absolutely.
How big are nuclear bombs?
Nowadays, they're anywhere from 1 kiloton or even a half a kiloton. I understand where...
Well, not so much in megatonnage. I'm an actual physical size.
Oh, physical size.
For example, the gravity bombs that you guys carried on B-52s, how big were those?
They were... I would say they're about 15 feet long, about 2 feet in diameter. This was the big ones, the B-81s, were about 18 inches to 2 feet in diameter, 15, 16 feet long, probably weighed about 2,500 pounds. On a rotary launcher, you could carry 8 of them.
Wow.
On the B-52s, we carried 4 of them in a clip-in rack in the forward part of the bomb bay. Most of the weapon was actually a parachute. They would, when you dropped them out of the B-52, they had a humongous parachute. They would drop out, and these things would land with the parachute behind them, and they would land fairly softly, and then they would sit on the ground for anywhere from 60 seconds to probably a minute and a half, and basically just tick, and that would allow the aircraft time to get away before going off.
Oh, that's right. You don't want to be above the bomb you just dropped.
Yeah.
Do you?
If they landed just without the parachute, they would probably just break apart. They were designed to land softly. Some of the short range attack missile, which isn't in service anymore, but that had a contact a fuse on it, where once it hit the ground, or once it descended through a certain altitude, it would go off
right.
In the air. Then it had a backup fuse where once it hit something, it would actually go off.
Dale, how far away from the bomb that you just dropped does a B-52 have to get to be safe?
We would get about 10 miles or so away, and we were if you were tail on to the explosion. We were assured, and again, that's one of those leaps of faith where they told us we could survive the blast effects and all the effects of a nuclear weapon. Of course, we're still low on a very low altitude, so you rely on the ground cover. These were ground explosions, so hopefully a lot of the terrain would sort of soak up the blast and things like that, but it, again, it was a leap of faith. You hoped you were far enough away. Of course, once you got rid of the weapon, the throttles went to maximum. You were at military power, or even went supersonic in the case of the FB-111. You wanted to get as far away from that
Absolutely.
As possible, and you didn't want to turn perpendicular to the blast. You didn't want to have the sides of the airplane exposed to the blast. You wanted your tail to be exposed to
The concern, the EMP, or the actual still buffeting from the explosion?
To the actual force of the explosion itself, the blast of heat. You wanted as little of the cross-section of the airplane exposed to that blast. So you didn't want to turn sideways to it. You didn't want to face it. So the crew had their eye protection on. The pilots would close off the lead curtains in the airplane. If they had to leave them open for navigation purposes, they had these really cool electronic goggles that would instantaneously darken if there was a flash of light outside. So called PLZT goggles, and I can't remember what that stood for, but they were very cool Darth Vader looking glasses that they wore in their helmets. And if they were required to have the curtains open, now that wouldn't protect you against the heat, but it would protect you against the light. So the rest of the crew either just put down their regular goggles, or else we also had lead eye patches that we would wear. And this is another one of those things that you lived with as a strategic bomber crew member, I mean, you put these eye patches on. When you copied the message and it said actual, as I did once, you had to get all the gear out of the box, just like Dr. Strangelove. You get the stuff out of the box, and one of the things you get out is the eye patch, and you put this thing on, and of course the engines are running and kind of confusion in the plane, but the idea behind the eye patch is that you put it over one eye, and if the curtains are open for some reason, usually a bad reason, and there's a flash of light outside, the exposed eye is going to be wiped out, maybe even destroyed.
So you've got one good eye left.
So the idea is that you're supposed to calmly and coolly and collectively take the eye patch from the good eye and put it over the bad eye, and then use the other eye to continue the mission. And it, I mean, theoretically, you know, we brief this stuff and we practice it in a simulator, but the first time you have to put that eye patch on after copying an actual message,
yes,
that was the defining moment in my life, sitting there in a B-52 with that eye patch on and realizing that you are about to very possibly fight World War III.
Do you remember how you felt?
It was, you feel very hard to describe. You realize that your life is on the line now, and you have a mission to do, and you don't know what else is going on in the world that prompted that actual message, but you know that bad things are happening out there, and now it's time to go to work.
All right.